She shrank closer to Rhett, took his arm in fingers that trembled and looked up at him for words, for comfort, for something reassuring. In the unholy crimson glow that bathed them, his dark profile stood out as clearly as the head on an ancient coin, beautiful, cruel, and decadent. At her touch he turned to her, his eyes gleaming with a light as frightening as the fire, to Scarlet. He seemed as exhilarated and contemptuous as if he got strong pleasure from the situation, as if he welcomed the inferno they were approaching. "Here," he said, laying a hand on one of the long-barreled pistols in his belt. "If anyone, black or white, comes up on your side of the wagon and tries to lay hand on the horse, shoot him, and we'll ask questions later. But for God's sake, don't shoot the nag in your excitement."
I have a pistol," she whispered, clutching the weapon in her lap, perfectly certain that if death stared her in the face, she would be too frightened to pull the trigger.
"You have? Where did you get it?"
"It's Charles's."
"Charles?"
"Yes, Charles. My husband."
"Did you ever really have a husband, my dear?" he whispered and laughed softly.
"If he would only be serious. If he would only hurry. How do you suppose I got my boy?" she cried fiercely.
"Oh, there are other ways than husbands."
"Will you hush and hurry?" But he drew rein abruptly, almost at Marietta Street, in the shadow of a warehouse not yet touched by the flames. "Hurry!" It was the only word in her mind. "Hurry! Hurry!"
"Soldiers," he said.
The detachment came down Marietta Street, between the burning buildings, walking at root step, tiredly, rifles held anyway, heads down, too weary to hurry. Too weary to care if timbers were crashing to right and left and smoke billowing about them. They were all ragged, so ragged that between officers and men there was no distinguishing insignia except here and there a torn hat brim pinned up with a wreathed CSA. Many were barefooted, and here and there a dirty bandage wrapped a head or arm. They went past, looking neither to left nor right, so silent that had it not been for the steady tramp of feet, they might all have been ghosts.
"Take a good look at them," came Rhett's jibing voice, "so you can tell your grandchildren you saw the rear guard of the glorious cause in retreat."
Suddenly she hated him. Hated him with a strength that momentarily overpowered her fear, made it seem petty and small. She knew her safety and that of the others in the back of the wagon depended on him and him alone, but she hated him for his sneering at those ragged ranks. She thought of Charles, who was dead, and Ashley, who might be dead, and all the gay and gallant young men who were rotting in shallow graves, and she forgot that she, too, had once thought them fools. She couldn't speak, but hatred and disgust burned in her eyes as she stared at him fiercely. As the last of the soldiers were passing, a small figure in the rear rank, his rifle butt dragging the ground, wavered, stopped and stared after the others with a dirty face so dulled by fatigue he looked like a sleepwalker. He was as small as Scarlet, so small his rifle was almost as tall as he was, and his grime-smeared face was unbearded. 16 at the most, thought Scarlet, irrelevantly. Must be one of the home guard or a runaway schoolboy. As she watched, the boy's knees buckled slowly, and he went down in the dust. Without a word, two men fell out of the last rank and walked back to him. One, a tall, spare man with a black beard that hung to his belt, silently handed his own rifle and that of the boy to the other. Then stooping. He jerked the boy to his shoulders with an ease that looked like sleight of hand. He started off slowly after the retreating column. His shoulders bowed under the weight, while the boy, weak, infuriated like a child teased by its elders, screamed out, "Put me down, damn you! Put me down! I can't walk!" The bearded man said nothing and plodded on out of sight around the bend of the road. Rhett sat still, the reins lax in his hands, looking after them, a curious moody look on his swarthy face. Then there was a crash of falling timbers nearby, and Scarlet saw a thin tongue of flame lick up over the roof of the warehouse in whose sheltering shadow they sat. Then pennons and battle flags of flame flared triumphantly to the sky above them. Smoke burnt her nostrils, and Wade and Prissy began coughing. The baby made soft sneezing sounds. "Oh, name of God, Rhett, are you crazy? Hurry! Hurry!" Rhett made no reply, but brought the tree limb down on the horse's back with a cruel force that made the animal leap forward. With all the speed the horse could summon, they jolted and bounced across Marietta Street. Ahead of them was a tunnel of fire where buildings were blazing on either side of the short, narrow street that led to the railroad tracks. They plunged into it. A glare brighter than a dozen suns dazzled their eyes. Scorching heat seared their skins, and the roaring, crackling, and crashing beat upon their ears in painful waves. For an eternity, it seemed, they were in the midst of flaming torment, and then, abruptly, they were in semi-darkness again. As they dashed down the street and bumped over the railroad tracks, Rhett applied the whip automatically. His face looked set and absent, as though he had forgotten where he was. His broad shoulders were hunched forward, and his chin jutted out as though the thoughts in his mind were not pleasant. The heat of the fire made sweat stream down his forehead and cheeks, but he didn't wipe it off. They pulled into a side street, then another, then turned and twisted from one narrow street to another until Scarlet completely lost her bearings, and the roaring of the flames died behind them. Still Rhett didn't speak. He only laid on the whip with regularity. The red glow in the sky was fading now, and the road became so dark, so frightening. Scarlet would have welcomed words, any words from him, even jeering, insulting words, words that cut. But he did not speak. Silent or not, she thanked heaven for the comfort of his presence. It was so good to have a man beside her, to lean close to him and feel the hard swell of his arm and know that he stood between her and unnameable terrors, even though he merely sat there and stared. "Oh, Rhett," she whispered, clasping his arm. "What would we ever have done without you? I'm so glad you aren't in the army." He turned his head and gave her one look, a look that made her drop his arm and shrink back. There was no mockery in his eyes now. They were naked, and there was anger and something like bewilderment in them. His lip curled down and he turned his head away. For a long time they jounced along in a silence unbroken, except for the faint wails of the baby and sniffles from Prissy. When she was able to bear the sniffling noise no longer, Scarlet turned and pinched her viciously, causing Prissy to scream in good earnest before she relapsed into frightened silence. Finally, Rhett turned the horse at right angles, and after a while, they were on a wider, smoother road. The dim shapes of houses grew farther and farther apart, and unbroken woods loomed wall-like on either side. "We're out of town now," said Rhett briefly, drawing rein, "and on the main road to Rough and Ready. Hurry, don't stop. Let the animal breathe a bit." Then, turning to her, he asked slowly, "Scarlet, are you still determined to do this crazy thing?"
"Do what?" Do you still want to try to get through to Terra?
It's suicidal.
Steve Lee's cavalry and the Yankee army are between you and Terra.
Oh, dear God! Was he going to refuse to take her home after all she'd gone through this terrible day?
Oh, yes! Yes! Please, Rhett, let's hurry. The horse isn't tired.
Just a minute. You can't go down to Jonesboro on this road. You can't follow the train tracks. They've been fighting up and down there all day from Rough and Ready on south. Do you know any other roads? Small wagon roads or lanes that don't go through Rough and Ready or Jonesboro?
Oh, yes, cried Scarlet in relief. If we can just get near to Rough and Ready, I know a wagon trace that winds off from the main Jonesboro road and wanders around for miles. Pa and I used to ride it. It comes out right near the McIntosh place, and that's only a mile from Terra.
Good. Maybe you can get past Rough and Ready all right. General Steve Lee was there during the afternoon covering the retreat. Maybe the Yankees aren't there yet. Maybe you can get through there if Steve Lee's men don't pick up your horse.
I can get through?
Yes.
You.
His voice was rough.
But Rhett, you... Aren't you going to take us?
No. I'm leaving you here.
She looked around wildly. At the livid sky behind them, at the dark trees on either hand hemming them in like a prison wall, at the frightened figures in the back of the wagon, and finally at him. Had she gone crazy? Was she not hearing right? He was grinning now. She could just see his white teeth in the faint light, and the old mockery was back in his eyes. Leaving us? Where are you going?
I am going, dear girl, with the army.
She sighed with relief and irritation. Why did he joke at this time of all times, Rhett in the army? After all he'd said about stupid fools who were enticed into losing their lives by a roll of drums and brave words from orators, fools who killed themselves that wise men might make money. Oh, I could choke you for scaring me so. Let's get on.
I'm not joking, my dear.
And I am hurt, Scarlet, that you do not take my gallant sacrifice with better spirit. Where's your patriotism, your love for our glorious cause? Now is your chance to tell me to return with my shield or on it. But talk fast, for I want time to make a brave speech before departing for the wars. His drawling voice jibed in her ears. He was jeering at her. And somehow she knew he was jeering at himself, too. What was he talking about? Patriotism, shields, brave speeches. It wasn't possible that he meant what he was saying. It just wasn't believable that he could talk so blithely of leaving her here on this dark road with a woman who might be dying, a newborn infant, a foolish black wench, and a frightened child, leaving her to pilot them through miles of battlefields and stragglers and Yankees and fire and God knows what. Once, when she was 6 years old, she had fallen from a tree flat on her stomach. She could still recall that sickening interval before breath came back into her body. Now, as she looked at Rhett, she felt the same way she had felt then, breathless, stunned, nauseated. Rhett, you are joking! She grabbed his arm and felt her tears of fright splash down on her wrist. He raised her hand and kissed it airily.
Selfish to the end, aren't you, my dear? Thinking only of your own precious hide and not of the gallant Confederacy. Think how our troops will be heartened by my 11th-hour appearance.
There was a malicious tenderness in his voice. Oh, Rhett, she wailed. How can you do this to me? Why are you leaving me?
Why? He laughed jauntily. Because... Perhaps of the betraying sentimentality that lurks in all of us Southerners. Perhaps because I'm ashamed. Who knows?
Ashamed? You should die of shame. To desert us here, alone, helpless.
Dear Scarlet, you aren't helpless. Anyone as selfish and determined as you are is never helpless. God help the Yankees if they should get you.
He stepped abruptly down from the wagon, and as she watched him, stunned with bewilderment, he came around to her side of the wagon.
Get out, he ordered.
She stared at him. He reached up roughly, caught her under the arms, and swung her to the ground beside him. With a tight grip on her, he dragged her several paces away from the wagon. She felt the dust and gravel in her slippers hurting her feet. The still hot darkness wrapped her like a dream.
I'm not asking you to understand or forgive. I don't give a damn whether you do either. For I shall never understand or forgive myself for this idiocy. I am annoyed at myself to find that so much quixoticism still lingers in me. But our fair Southland needs every man. Didn't our brave Governor Brown say just that? No matter. I'm off to the wars.
He laughed suddenly, a ringing free laugh that startled the echoes in the dark woods.
I could not love thee, dear, so much, loved I not honor more. That's a pat speech, isn't it? Certainly better than anything I can think up myself at the present moment. For I do love you, Scarlet, in spite of what I said that night on the porch last month.
His drawl was caressing, and his hand slid up her bare arms, warm, strong hands.
I love you, Scarlet. Because we are so much alike. Renegades, both of us, dear. And selfish rascals. Neither of us cares a rap if the whole world goes to pot. So long as we are safe and comfortable.
His voice went on in the darkness, and she heard words, but they made no sense to her. Her mind was tiredly trying to take in the harsh truth that he was leaving her to face the Yankees alone. Her mind said, "He's leaving me, he's leaving me," but no emotion stirred. Then his arms went around her waist and shoulders, and she felt the hard muscles of his thighs against her body and the buttons of his coat pressing into her breast. A warm tide of feeling, bewildering, frightening, swept over her, carrying out of her mind the time and place and circumstances. She felt as limp as a rag doll, warm, weak and helpless. And his supporting arms were so pleasant.
You don't want to change your mind about what I said last month? There's nothing like danger and death to give an added fillip.
Be patriotic, Scarlet. Think how you would be sending a soldier to his death with beautiful memories. He was kissing her now, and his mustache tickled her mouth, kissing her with slow, hot lips that were as leisurely as though he had the whole night before him. Charles had never kissed her like this. Never had the kisses of the Tarleton and Calvert boys made her go hot and cold and shaky like this. He bent her body backward, and his lips traveled down her throat to where the cameo fastened her basque.
"Sweet," he whispered. "Sweet."
She saw the wagon dimly in the dark, and heard the treble piping of Wade's voice.
"Mother? Wade frightened."
Into her swaying, darkened mind, cold sanity came back with a rush, and she remembered what she had forgotten for the moment, that she was frightened too, and Rhett was leaving her. Leaving her, the damned cad. And on top of it all, he had the consummate gall to stand here in the road and insult her with his infamous proposals. Rage and hate flowed into her and stiffened her spine, and with one wrench she tore herself loose from his arms. "Oh, you cad!" she cried. And her mind leaped about, trying to think of worse things to call him. Things she had heard Gerald call Mr. Lincoln, the Macintoshes, and balky mules. But the words wouldn't come. "You low-down, cowardly, nasty, stinking thing!" And because she couldn't think of anything crushing enough, she drew back her arm and slapped him across the mouth with all the force she had left. He took a step backward, his hand going to his face. "Ah," he said quietly. And for a moment they stood facing each other in the darkness. Scarlet could hear his heavy breathing, and her own breath came in gasps, as if she had been running hard. "They were right. Everybody was right. You aren't a gentleman." "My dear girl," he said, "how inadequate." She knew he was laughing, and the thought goaded her. "Go on. Go on now. I want you to hurry. I don't want to ever see you again. I hope a cannonball lands right on you. I hope it blows you to a million pieces. Never mind the rest. I follow your general idea. When I'm dead on the altar of my country, I hope your conscience hurts you." She heard him laugh as he turned away and walked back toward the wagon. She saw him stand beside it, heard him speak, and his voice was changed, courteous and respectful, as it always was when he spoke to Melanie. "Mrs. Wilkes?" Prissy's frightened voice made answer from the wagon. "God almighty, Captain Butler, Miss Melanie done fainted way back yonder." "She's not dead? Is she breathing?"
"Yes, sir, she breathing."
"Then she's probably better off as she is. If she were conscious, I doubt she could live through all the pain. Take good care of her, Prissy. Here's a shin plaster for you. Try not to be a bigger fool than you are."
"Yes, sir. Thank you, sir."
"Goodbye, Scarlet." She knew he had turned and was facing her, but she didn't speak. Hate choked all utterance. His feet ground on the pebbles of the road, and for a moment she saw his big shoulders looming up in the dark. Then he was gone. She could hear the sound of his feet for a while, and then they died away. She came slowly back to the wagon, her knees shaking. Why had he gone? Stepping off into the dark, into the war, into a cause that was lost, into a world that was mad? Why had he gone? Rhett, who loved the pleasures of women and liquor, the comfort of good food and soft beds, the feel of fine linen and good leather, who hated the South and jeered at the fools who fought for it. Now he had set his varnished boots upon a bitter road where hunger tramped with tireless stride, and wounds and weariness and heartbreak ran like yelping wolves. And the end of the road was death. He need not have gone. He was safe, rich, comfortable. But he had gone, leaving her alone in a night as black as blindness, with the Yankee army between her and home. Now she remembered all the bad names she had wanted to call him, but it was too late. She leaned her head against the bowed neck of the horse and cried. Chapter 24. The bright glare of morning sunlight streaming through the trees overhead awakened Scarlet. For a moment, stiffened by the cramped position in which she had slept, she couldn't remember where she was. The sun blinded her. The hard boards of the wagon under her were harsh against her body, and a heavy weight lay across her legs. She tried to sit up, and discovered that the weight was Wade, who lay sleeping with his head pillowed on her knees. Melanie's bare feet were almost in her face, And under the wagon seat, Prissy was curled up like a black cat with a small baby wedged in between her and Wade. Then she remembered everything. She popped up to a sitting position and looked hastily all around. Thank God, no Yankees in sight. Their hiding place had not been discovered in the night. It all came back to her now. The nightmare journey after Rhett's footsteps died away. The endless night. The black road full of ruts and boulders along which they jolted. The deep gullies on either side into which the wagon slipped. The fear-crazed strength with which she and Prissy had pushed the wheels out of the gullies. She recalled with a shudder how often she had driven the unwilling horse into fields and woods when she heard soldiers approaching, not knowing if they were friends or foes. Recalled, too, her anguish lest a cough, a sneeze, or Wade's hiccuping might betray them to the marching men. Oh, that dark road where men went by like ghosts. Voices stilled. Only the muffled tramping of feet on soft dirt, the faint clicking of bridles and the straining creak of leather. And oh, that dreadful moment when the sick horse balked, and cavalry and light cannon rumbled past in the darkness, past where they sat breathless, so close she could almost reach out and touch them, so close she could smell the stale sweat on the soldiers' bodies. When at last they had neared Rough and Ready, a few campfires were gleaming where the last of Steve Lee's rear guard was awaiting orders to fall back. She had circled through a plowed field for a mile, until the light of the fires died out behind her. And then she had lost her way in the darkness, and sobbed when she couldn't find the little wagon path she knew so well. Then finally, having found it, the horse sank in the traces and refused to move. Refused to rise even when she and Prissy tugged at the bridle. So she had unharnessed him and crawled, sodden with fatigue, into the back of the wagon and stretched her aching legs. She had a faint memory of Melanie's voice before sleep clamped down her eyelids. A weak voice that apologized even as it begged.
"Scarlet, can I have some water, please?"
She had said, "There isn't any," and gone to sleep before the words were out of her mouth. Now it was morning, and the world was still and serene and green and gold with dappled sunshine, and no soldiers in sight anywhere. She was hungry and dry with thirst, aching and cramped and filled with wonder that she, Scarlet O'Hara, who could never rest well except between linen sheets and on the softest of feather beds, had slept like a field hand on hard planks. Blinking in the sunlight, her eyes fell on Melanie, and she gasped, horrified. Melanie lay so still and white, Scarlet thought she must be dead. She looked dead. She looked like a dead old woman with her ravaged face and her dark hair snarled and tangled across it. Then Scarlet saw with relief the faint rise and fall of her shallow breathing and knew that Melanie had survived the night. Scarlet shaded her eyes with her hand and looked about her. They had evidently spent the night under the trees in someone's front yard, for a sand and gravel driveway stretched out before her, winding away under an avenue of cedars. "Why, it's the Mallory place," she thought, her heart leaping with gladness at the thought of friends and help. But a stillness as of death hung over the plantation. The shrubs and grass of the lawn were cut to pieces where hooves and wheels and feet had torn frantically back and forth until the soil was churned up. She looked toward the house, and instead of the old white clabbered place she knew so well, she saw there only a long rectangle of blackened granite foundation stones and two tall chimneys rearing smoke-stained bricks into the charred leaves of still trees. She drew a deep, shuddering breath. Would she find Terra like this, level with the ground, silent as the dead? "I mustn't think about that now," she told herself hurriedly. "I mustn't let myself think about it. I'll get scared again if I think about it." But in spite of herself, Her heart quickened, and each beat seemed to thunder, "Home, hurry, home, hurry." They must be starting on toward home again. But first they must find some food and water, especially water. She prodded Prissy awake. Prissy rolled her eyes as she looked about her.
"Forgot, Miss Scarlet. I didn't expect to wake up again except in the Promised Land."
"You're a long way from there," said Scarlet, trying to smooth back her untidy hair. Her face was damp and her body was already wet with sweat. She felt dirty and messy and sticky, almost as if she smelled bad. Her clothes were crushed and wrinkled from sleeping in them, and she had never felt more acutely tired and sore in all her life. Muscles she didn't know she possessed ached from her unaccustomed exertions of the night before, and every movement brought sharp pain. She looked down at Melanie and saw that her dark eyes were opened. They were sick eyes, fever-bright, and dark baggy circles were beneath them. She opened cracking lips and whispered appealingly, "Water." "Get up, Prissy," ordered Scarlet. "We'll go to the well and get some water."
"But, Miss Scarlet, there might be haunts up there. Supposing somebody dead up there."
"I'll make a haunt out of you if you don't get out of this wagon," said Scarlet, who was in no mood for argument, and she climbed lamely down to the ground. And then she thought of the horse. Name of God! Suppose the horse had died in the night? He had seemed ready to die when she unharnessed him. She ran around the wagon and saw him lying on his side. If he were dead, she would curse God and die too. Somebody in the Bible had done just that thing, cursed God and died. She knew just how that person felt. But the horse was alive, breathing heavily, sick eyes half closed, but alive. Well, some water would help him too. Prissy climbed reluctantly from the wagon with many groans and timorously followed Scarlet up the avenue. Behind the ruins, the row of whitewashed slave quarters stood silent and deserted under the overhanging trees. Between the quarters and the smoked stone foundations, they found the well, and the roof of it still stood with the bucket far down the well. Between them, they wound up the rope, and when the bucket of cool, sparkling water appeared out of the dark depths, Scarlet tilted it to her lips and drank with loud sucking noises, spilling the water all over herself. She drank until Prissy's petulant,
"Well, as thirsty too, Miss Scarlet,"
made her recall the needs of the others. "Untie the knot and take the bucket to the wagon and give them some. And give the rest to the horse. Don't you think Miss Melanie ought to nurse the baby? He'll starve."
"Law, Miss Scarlet, Miss Melly ain't got no milk. Ain't gwine have none."
"How do you know?"
"I see too many like her."
"Don't go putting on airs with me. A precious little you knew about babies yesterday. Hurry now. I'm going to try to find something to eat." Scarlet's search was futile, until in the orchard she found a few apples. Soldiers had been there before her, and there were none on the trees. Those she found on the ground were mostly rotten. She filled a skirt with the best of them and came back across the soft earth, collecting small pebbles in her slippers. Why hadn't she thought of putting on stouter shoes last night? Why hadn't she brought her sun hat? Why hadn't she brought something to eat? She'd acted like a fool. But of course, she'd thought Rhett would take care of them. Rhett! She spat on the ground, for the very name tasted bad. How she hated him! How contemptible he had been! And she had stood there in the road and let him kiss her, and almost liked it. She had been crazy last night. How despicable he was! When she came back, she divided up the apples and threw the rest into the back of the wagon. The horse was on his feet now, but the water didn't seem to have refreshed him much.
He looked far worse in the daylight than he had the night before. His hip bones stood out like an old cow's. His ribs showed like a washboard, and his back was a mass of sores. She shrank from touching him as she harnessed him. When she slipped the bit into his mouth, she saw that he was practically toothless. As old as the hills. While Rhett was stealing a horse, why couldn't he have stolen a good one? She mounted the seat and brought down the hickory limb on his back. He wheezed and started, but he walked. So slowly as she turned him into the road, she knew she could walk faster herself with no effort whatever. Oh, if only she didn't have Melanie and Wade and the baby and Prissy to bother with. How swiftly she could walk home. Why, she would run home, run every step of the way that would bring her closer to Tara and to Mother. They couldn't be more than 15 miles from home, but at the rate this old nag traveled, it would take all day, for she would have to stop frequently to rest him. All day. She looked down the glaring red road, cut in deep ruts where cannon wheels and ambulances had gone over it. It would be hours before she knew if Tara still stood, and if Ellen were there. It would be hours before she finished her journey, under the broiling September sun. She looked back at Melanie, who lay with sick eyes closed against the sun, and jerked loose the strings of her bonnet and tossed it to Prissy. "Put that over her face. It'll keep the sun out of her eyes." Then, as the heat beat down upon her unprotected head, she thought, "I'll be as freckled as a guinea egg before this day is over." She had never in her life been out in the sunshine without a hat or veils. Never handled reins without gloves to protect the white skin of her dimpled hands. Yet here she was, exposed to the sun in a broken-down wagon, with a broken-down horse, dirty, sweaty, hungry, helpless to do anything but plod along at a snail's pace through a deserted land. What a few short weeks it had been since she was safe and secure. What a little while since she and everyone else had thought that Atlanta could never fall, that Georgia could never be invaded. But the small cloud which appeared in the northwest 4 months ago had blown up into a mighty storm, and then into a screaming tornado, sweeping away her world, whirling her out of her sheltered life, and dropping her down in the midst of this still, haunted desolation. Was Tara still standing? Or was Tara also gone with the wind, which had swept through Georgia? She laid the whip on the tired horse's back and tried to urge him on, while the waggling wheels rocked them drunkenly from side to side. There was death in the air. In the rays of the late afternoon sun, every well-remembered field and forest grove was green and still, with an unearthly quiet that struck terror to Scarlet's heart. Every empty, shell-pitted house they had passed that day, every gaunt chimney standing sentinel over smoke-blackened ruins, had frightened her more. They hadn't seen a living human being or animal since the night before. Dead men and dead horses, yes, and dead mules lying by the road, swollen, covered with flies, but nothing alive. No far-off cattle load, no birds sang, no wind waved the trees, only the tired plop-plop of the horse's feet and the weak wailing of Melanie's baby broke the stillness. The countryside lay as under some dread enchantment. Or worse still, thought Scarlet with a chill, like the familiar and dear face of a mother, beautiful and quiet at last, after death agonies. She felt that the once familiar woods were full of ghosts. Thousands had died in the fighting near Jonesboro. They were here in these haunted woods where the slanting afternoon sun gleamed eerily through unmoving leaves, friends and foes,
peering at her in her rickety wagon. Through eyes blinded with blood and red dust, glazed, horrible eyes.
"Mother! Mother!" she whispered. If she could only win to Ellen. If only, by a miracle of God, Tara were still standing and she could drive up the long avenue of trees and go into the house and see her mother's kind, tender face, could feel once more the soft, capable hands that drove out fear, could clutch Ellen's skirts and bury her face in them. Mother would know what to do. She wouldn't let Melanie and her baby die. She would drive away all ghosts and fears with her quiet, "Hush, hush!" But Mother was ill, perhaps dying. Scarlet laid the whip across the weary rump of the horse. They must go faster. They had crept along this never-ending road all the long, hot day. Soon it would be night, and they would be alone in this desolation that was death. She gripped the reins tighter with hands that were blistered and slapped them fiercely on the horse's back, her aching arms burning at the movement. If she could only reach the kind arms of Tara and Ellen and lay down her burdens, far too heavy for her young shoulders. The dying woman, the fading baby, her own hungry little boy, the frightened Negro, all looking to her for strength, for guidance, all reading in her straight-back courage she did not possess, and strength which had long since failed. The exhausted horse didn't respond to the whip or reins, but shambled on, dragging his feet, stumbling on small rocks and swaying as if ready to fall to his knees. But as twilight came, they at last entered the final lap of the long journey. They rounded the bend of the wagon path and turned into the main road. Tara was only a mile away. Here loomed up the dark bulk of the mock-orange hedge that marked the beginning of the McIntosh property. A little farther on, Scarlet drew rein in front of the avenue of oaks that led from the road to old Angus McIntosh's house. She peered through the gathering dusk down the two lines of ancient trees. All was dark. Not a single light showed in the house or in the quarters. Straining her eyes in the darkness, she dimly discerned a sight which had grown familiar through that terrible day. Two tall chimneys, like gigantic tombstones towering above the ruined second floor, and broken unlit windows blotching the wall like still, blind eyes. "Hello!" she shouted, summoning all her strength. "Hello!" Prissy clawed at her in a frenzy of fright, and Scarlet, turning, saw that her eyes were rolling in her head. "Don't holler, Miss Scarlet. Please don't holler again," she whispered, her voice shaking. "There ain't no telling what might answer."
"Dear God," thought Scarlet, a shiver running through her. "Dear God, she's right. Anything might come out of there." She flapped the reins and urged the horse forward. The sight of the McIntosh house had pricked the last bubble of hope remaining to her. It was burned, in ruins, deserted, as were all the plantations she had passed that day. Tara lay only a half a mile away, on the same road, right in the path of the army. Tara was leveled too. She would find only the blackened bricks, starlight shining through the roofless walls. Ellen and Gerald gone. The girl's gone, Mammy gone, the Negro's gone, God knows where, and this hideous stillness over everything. Why had she come on this fool's errand, against all common sense, dragging Melanie and her child? Better that they had died in Atlanta than tortured by this day of burning sun and jolting wagon to die in the silent ruins of Tara. But Ashley had left Melanie in her care. "Take care of her." Oh, that beautiful, heartbreaking day when he had kissed her goodbye before he went away forever. "You'll take care of her, won't you? Promise." And she had promised.
Why had she ever bound herself with such a promise, doubly binding now that Ashley was gone? Even in her exhaustion, she hated Melanie, hated the tiny mewing voice of her child, which fainter and fainter pierced the stillness. But she had promised, and now they belonged to her. Even as Wade and Prissy belonged to her, and she must struggle and fight for them as long as she had strength or breath. She could have left them in Atlanta, dumped Melanie into the hospital and deserted her. But had she done that, she could never face Ashley, either on this earth or in the hereafter, and tell him that she had left his wife and child to die among strangers. Oh, Ashley! Where was he tonight while she toiled down this haunted road with his wife and baby? Was he alive, and did he think of her as he lay behind the bars at Rock Island? Or was he dead of smallpox months ago, rotting in some long ditch with hundreds of other Confederates? Scarlett's taut nerves almost cracked as a sudden noise sounded in the underbrush near them. Prissy screamed loudly, throwing herself to the floor of the wagon, the baby beneath her. Melanie stirred feebly, her hands seeking the baby, and Wade covered his eyes and cowered, too frightened to cry. Then the bushes beside them crashed apart under the heavy hooves, and a low moaning bawl assaulted their ears. "It's only a cow," said Scarlett, her voice rough with fright. "Don't be a fool, Prissy. You've mashed the baby and frightened Miss Melly and Wade."
"It's a ghost," moaned Prissy, writhing face down on the wagon boards.
Turning deliberately, Scarlett raised the tree limb she had been using as a whip and brought it down across Prissy's back. She was too exhausted and weak from fright to tolerate weakness in anyone else.
"Sit up, you fool," she said, "before I wear this out on you."
Yelping, Prissy raised her head and, peering over the side of the wagon, saw it was indeed a cow, a red and white animal which stood looking at them appealingly with large, frightened eyes. Opening its mouth, it lowed again as if in pain.
"Is it hurt?"
"That doesn't sound like an ordinary moo."
"Sound to me like her bag full and she need milkin' bad," said Prissy, regaining some measure of control. "Speck it one of Mr. McIntosh's dat the niggers drive into woods and the Yankees didn't get."
"We'll take it with us," Scarlett decided swiftly. "Then we can have some milk for the baby."
"How are we gwine take a cow with us, Miss Scarlett? We can't take no cow with us. Cow ain't no good nohow, even she ain't been milked lately. The bag swells up and busts. That's why she hollerin'.
Since you know so much about it, take off your petticoat and tear it up and tie it to the back of the wagon."
"Miss Scarlett, you knows I ain't had no petticoat for a month, and did I have one, I wouldn't put it on her for nothin'. I never had no truck with cows. I'se scared of cows."
Scarlett laid down the reins and pulled up her skirt. The lace-trimmed petticoat beneath was the last garment she possessed that was pretty and whole. She untied the waist tape and slipped it down over her feet, crushing the soft linen folds between her hands. Rhett had brought her that linen and lace from Nassau on the last boat he slipped through the blockade, and she had worked a week to make the garment. Resolutely, she took it by the hem and jerked, put it in her mouth and gnawed, until finally the material gave with a rip and tore the length. She gnawed furiously, tore with both hands, and the petticoat lay in strips in her hands. She knotted the ends with fingers that bled from blisters and shook from fatigue. "Slip this over her horns," she directed. But Prissy balked.
"I'm scared of cows, Miss Scarlett. I ain't never had nothing to do with cows. I ain't no yard nigger. I's a house nigger."
"You're a fool nigger. And the worst day's work Pa ever did was to buy you," said Scarlett slowly, too tired for anger. "And if I ever get the use of my arm again, I'll wear this whip out on you." There, she thought. I've said nigger, and Mother wouldn't like that at all.
Prissy rolled her eyes wildly, peeping first at the set face of her mistress, and then at the cow which bawled plaintively. Scarlet seemed the less dangerous of the two, so Prissy clutched at the sides of the wagon and remained where she was. Stiffly, Scarlet climbed down from the seat, each movement an agony of aching muscles. Prissy was not the only one who was scared of cows. Scarlet had always feared them. Even the mildest cow seemed sinister to her. But this was no time to truckle to small fears when great ones crowded so thick upon her. Fortunately, the cow was gentle. In its pain, it had sought human companionship and help, and it made no threatening gesture as she looped one end of the torn petticoat about its horns. She tied the other end to the back of the wagon as securely as her awkward fingers would permit. Then, as she started back toward the driver's seat, a vast weariness assailed her, and she swayed dizzily. She clutched the side of the wagon to keep from falling. Melanie opened her eyes, and, seeing Scarlet standing beside her, whispered, "Dear, are we home?" "Home." Hot tears came to Scarlet's eyes at the word. Home. Melanie didn't know there was no home, and that they were alone in a mad and desolate world. "Not yet," she said, as gently as the constriction of her throat would permit. "But we will be soon. I've just found a cow, and soon we'll have some milk for you and the baby." "Poor baby," whispered Melanie, her hand creeping feebly toward her child and falling short. Climbing back into the wagon required all the strength Scarlet could muster. But at last it was done, and she picked up the lines. The horse stood with head drooping dejectedly and refused to start. Scarlet laid on the whip mercilessly. She hoped God would forgive her for hurting a tired animal. If he didn't, she was sorry. After all, Tara lay just ahead, and after the next quarter of a mile, the horse could drop in the shafts if he liked. Finally, he started slowly, the wagon creaking, and the cow lowing mournfully at every step. The pained animal's voice rasped on Scarlet's nerves until she was tempted to stop and untie the beast. What good would the cow do them anyway, if there should be no one at Tara? She couldn't milk her, and even if she could, the animal would probably kick anyone who touched her sore udders. But she had the cow, and she might as well keep her. There was little else she had in this world now. Scarlet's eyes grew misty when, at last, they reached the bottom of a gentle incline, for just over the rise lay Tara. Then her heart sank. The decrepit animal would never pull the hill. The slope had always seemed so slight, so gradual, in days when she galloped up it on her fleet-footed mare. It didn't seem possible it could have grown so steep since she saw it last. The horse would never make it with a heavy load. Wearily she dismounted and took the animal by the bridle. "Get out, Prissy," she commanded, "and take Wade. Either carry him or make him walk. Lay the baby by Miss Melanie." Wade broke into sobs and whimperings from which Scarlet could only distinguish, "Doc, Doc, Wade frightened. Miss Scarlet, I can't walk. My feet's done blistered and days through my shoes. And Wade and me don't weigh so much and get out. Get out before I pull you out. And if I do, I'm going to leave you right here in the dark by yourself. Quick now." Prissy moaned, peering at the dark trees that closed about them on both sides of the road. Trees which might reach out and clutch her if she left the shelter of the wagon. But she laid the baby beside Melanie, scrambled to the ground, and reaching up, lifted Wade out. The little boy sobbed, shrinking close to his nurse.
"Make him hush. I can't stand it," said Scarlet, taking the horse by the bridle and pulling him to a reluctant start. "Be a little man, Wade, and stop crying, or I will come over there and slap you."
Why had God invented children, she thought savagely as she turned her ankle cruelly on the dark road. Useless crying nuisances they were, always demanding care, always in the way.
In her exhaustion, there was no room for compassion for the frightened child, trotting by Prissy's side, dragging at her hand and sniffling. Only a weariness that she had borne him. Only a tired wonder that she had ever married Charles Hamilton.
"Miss Scarlet,"
whispered Prissy, clutching her mistress's arm.
"Don't let's go to Tara. They's not there. They's all done gone. Maybe they dead, Ma and all of 'em."
The echo of her own thoughts infuriated her, and Scarlet shook off the pinching fingers. "Then give me Wade's hand. You could sit right down here and stay."
No,
"Then hush." How slowly the horse moved. The moisture from his slobbering mouth dripped down upon her hand. Through her mind ran a few words of the song she had once sung with Rhett. She couldn't recall the rest.
"Just a few more days for to tote the weary load.
Just a few more steps," hummed her brain over and over. "Just a few more steps for to tote the weary load." Then they topped the rise, and before them lay the oaks of Tara, a towering dark mass against the darkening sky. Scarlet looked hastily to see if there was a light anywhere. There was none. "They are gone," said her heart, like a cold lead in her breast. Gone. She turned the horse's head into the driveway, and the cedars, meeting over their heads, cast them into midnight blackness. Peering up the long tunnel of darkness, straining her eyes, she saw a head. Or did she see? Were her tired eyes playing her tricks? The white bricks of Tara blurred and indistinct. Home! Home! The dear white walls, the windows with fluttering curtains, the wide verandas. Were they all there ahead of her, in the gloom? Or did the darkness mercifully conceal such a horror as the McIntosh house? The avenue seemed miles long, and the horse, pulling stubbornly at her hand, plopped slower and slower. Eagerly her eyes searched the darkness. The roof seemed to be intact. Could it be? Could it be? No, it wasn't possible. War stopped for nothing, not even Tara, built to last 500 years. It could not have passed over Tara. Then the shadowy outline did take form. She pulled the horse forward faster. The white walls did show there through the darkness, and untarnished by smoke. Tara had escaped. Home! She dropped the bridle and ran the last few steps, leaped forward with an urge to clutch the walls themselves in her arms. Then she saw a form, shadowy in the dimness, emerging from the blackness of the front veranda and standing at the top of the steps. Tara was not deserted. Someone was home. A cry of joy rose to her throat and died there. The house was so dark and still, and the figure did not move or call to her. What was wrong? What was wrong? Tara stood intact, yet shrouded with the same eerie quiet that hung over the whole stricken countryside. Then the figure moved, stiffly and slowly. It came down the steps. "Pa?" she whispered huskily, doubting almost that it was he.
"It's me, Katie Scarlet. I've come home.
Gerald moved toward her, silent as a sleepwalker, his stiff leg dragging. He came close to her,